It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest makes the case that the struggle against climate change has failed, but he says we still need to take action. First, two U.S. appeals court panels issued conflicting rulings on the federal subsidies portion of the Affordable Care Act today. At issue are the tax credits used to subsidize health care costs for those who live in states that didn't set up statewide exchanges. That group of states includes Wisconsin. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th District in Richmond ruled the federal subsidies were legal. The court said IRS interpretation of the law was a permissible exercise of the agency's discretion. But a few hours earlier, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit ruled the government could not subsidize health care for those participating in the federal exchange as opposed to the state exchanges. Here to explain these rulings and what they could mean for the future of the Affordable Care Act, we have Kyle Chaney. He's a reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, it was bad news, good news in that order from the perspective of the White House. What kind of reactions were we hearing as these rulings came down?
I think the reaction you heard from supporters of the healthcare law was very immediately was don't panic. This though the ruling from the D.C. Circuit, which, as you said, would basically end subsidies available to people who bought health insurance through the federal exchange, healthcare.gov. Again, that's 2/3 of the states. That would be, you know, catastrophic for the healthcare law and could lead to millions of people losing coverage. But again, there is a conflicting ruling. And it's going to wend its way through the courts for months, if not years, before there's actually a final determination.
Let's tackle each of today's rulings in turn. That one from the District of Columbia Circuit ruled, as we mentioned, against federal subsidies in states that didn't set up their own exchanges. What was the argument for overturning that part of the Affordable Care Act?
The argument there was that the law, essentially the intent there was that subsidies were only supposed to be available through exchanges built by states. The language of the law kind of says that plainly, but the argument against that has always been that the intent was always that every state would build its own exchange and that the federal government would step in where a state could not or would not, but that those would still be technically sort of run by the states. What the court said is, no, the law kind of is not just ambiguous on that, it actually says something completely different. So we can't support this idea that the federal exchange should be doling out subsidies when the law doesn't actually give it the authority to do that. Though the law doesn't give the authority, the IRS actually issued a rule that allowed those subsidies to start flowing. So this ruling basically vacates what the IRS did.
But there wasn't any kind of injunction from that. It doesn't mean that things change right now. Is that right?
Exactly. So the status quo is still in effect and will be for some time. So that's why I think you're hearing from supporters of Obamacare say, hey, take a breath. Let's wait and see how this plays out. We think it's going to get overturned when this goes to the full D.C. Court of Appeals, not just this three-judge panel. And if not, you could actually even see this go back to the Supreme Court because you have conflicting rulings.
And that's not a gimme that it's necessarily going to go to that full court, right? The Obama administration is trying to, they're filing to get that to happen.
Right. They're convinced, I think, that they also have the makeup of the right judges on that court that would look favorably on their argument. But no, it's not a guarantee. And again, when you have conflicting rulings at the appeals level, it's not those are usually ripe for what the Supreme Court takes a look at, too.
And over at this 4th District Court of Appeals in Richmond, they ruled, in effect, in favor of the Obama administration. What was the prevailing argument there?
Exactly. The argument there wasn't so much that the administration got it right, but that the law was so unclearly worded and ambiguous that they couldn't rule against the administration. It was that it seemed, you know, depending on how you parse it, that either argument could be right, and therefore the IRS was correct to or could be correct in issuing subsidies the way that it did, and so therefore they couldn't strike it. So it wasn't quite a wholehearted endorsement of the administration's argument, but definitely would preserve the subsidy situation as it is today.
This is a suit, or there have been a lot of suits, I should say, around the country from citizens, but backed by, in many cases, conservative think tanks or legal organizations. What were we hearing from them after, especially the District of Columbia ruling striking it down?
I think you're hearing mostly in the political realm, because I think even the conservatives who are happy with the ruling know that it's going to be several more shoes to drop before it's final. So what I think you're hearing now, especially from Republicans and conservatives, that hey, this is what we've been saying all along. This law is so poorly worded. This law is so badly crafted that the courts, not only are they conflicted, some of them even think that a big piece of the law needs to be overturned. But you know, this is a symptom of how rushed and poor, I guess, the process of crafting the law was.
Now, the rulings affect 36 states, including us here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. If that ruling we were just talking about, the one striking down these subsidies, went through, what would that mean for how the Affordable Care Act works in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
It's funny because Wisconsin's almost in its own category, because Governor Walker's health reform plan relies on the federal exchange to when he transferred people off of Badger Care there. So in some ways, Wisconsin may see a disproportionate impact if that ruling were to be upheld. But in general, it just means that states could have thousands, tens of thousands of people who, for all of a sudden, health care becomes unaffordable for them through the federal exchange, and would either have to get exemptions or find another way to get coverage, and that could be, from a policy point of view, from a well-being point of view, really a catastrophic situation.
Well, out there in the news lately, we saw the Supreme Court, become known as the Hobby Lobby ruling, allowing some companies to exempt themselves from covering contraception. It was a big deal, but it was kind of an around-the-edges sort of thing for the Affordable Care Act. This is much more at the core, isn't it?
This is at the heart. This is really, the Hobby Lobby situation was very controversial, and it attracts a lot of, political intrigue, and this religious conflict is important to a lot of people. But in terms of what the Affordable Care Act needs to function, the ability to offer subsidies through the exchanges is absolutely central to making this law work and extending coverage to as many people as were able to receive it. So the law would be completely almost dismantled in a way if this ruling were upheld.
This would mean that I've seen different numbers, including numbers like 5 million people, mm-hmm. maybe, would now not be able to afford this unsubsidized coverage, so
yep.
They can't get the coverage, but they're required to get the coverage.
Although there is a mechanism that says if you can't afford the coverage, you're not required anymore, so you'd be exempt from any penalties, but then you're still left with lots of people without insurance, and that may be a bigger issue in some respects.
Do you get a sense from opponents of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that they are hoping to destroy the whole thing in court, or are they doing it all fronts? They're hoping Republicans take control of the legislature, then the presidency, and do it that way instead.
Yeah, I think it's sort of an all hands on deck kind of thing. The courts was just one avenue where they've been hoping to chip away at it. I think when they lost in 2012 on the individual mandate argument, which is also a central component, I think the strategy shifted towards the politics. But the Hobby Lobby ruling and this ruling in particular sort of revived that hope, I think, that the courts could be a venue to really get at the law.
We've seen the Affordable Care Act in the Supreme Court a couple times now. If these conflicting appeals court rulings, and I think others coming down the line, go through to the Supreme Court, when would that be? When would they take it up?
It's unclear whether, I've talked to some colleagues who sort of track the workings of the court, and they seem to think that it could be conceivably the next term, so next year, but it may be an additional year, too. So we could be talking about a status quo situation for a couple years. In a way that would potentially go past at least the midterm elections, but would definitely be a long-term situation.
Kyle, thanks so much for joining us today.
You got it.
That's Kyle Chaney. He's a reporter for Politico. Climate change has been a lot of news so far this year. In March, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, warned of the impact climate change can have on global food supply, human security, and the world's economies. In May, federal agencies released their biggest yet assessment of climate threats here in the U.S. Last month, the EPA imposed limits on greenhouse gases from existing power plants. Today, we hear the previous 2 months were both record breakers when it came to high global temperatures. Add it all up, our guest says, we are currently failing in the battle against climate change. With us now is Dale Jamieson. He is Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, formerly associated with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. His new book is Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So past tense, you write, failed. It's already failed. Make the case that we are already on the downslope.
Well, we have already acted in such a way as to commit the planet to more than 1,000 years of warming. Our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren will live in a very different world than the one in which we grew up.
Why did we fail? What was it about our thoughts and our actions that led to this?
Well, the interesting thing about climate change is that I have a friend, an economist friend, who once said if you wanted to design a pill that would put an end to humanity, it would have many of the qualities of climate change. It's a problem that's long-term. It's a problem whose effects are very indirect, very dissociated from the causes. Evolution didn't build us to respond to the buildup of colorless, odorless gases in the atmosphere. It's a really difficult problem. And then you layer on top of that the dysfunctions of our political system, the problem in our short-term economic thinking, the fact that our ethical and moral systems are really about what one person does to another person at present tense. It's just not a problem that we're geared up to solve. And so we've got to learn how to solve these kinds of problems, because these are the kinds of problems that we're going to see more and more in population-dense, high-technology societies.
And this is, in many ways, as you say, an ethical problem. How do we recalibrate our ethics from worrying about direct harm I do someone to being a big part of a big complicated system of doing harm to people down the road?
Well, that's obviously a question for which there's no simple answer and no short-run answer. It's one that's going to require a kind of moral revolution in our thinking. But we're going to have to get our arms around this problem even before our moral systems and our economic systems are able to deal with them. We're going to have to look past some of these really almost insuperable difficulties and focus on things that are relatively simple in order to reduce the warming and to allow us to adapt.
And as you say, there's no one perfect solution. There's no superhero waiting in the wings to save us. Is that part of what's made it difficult for us to tackle this?
That's right. We keep waiting for the adult in the room to come and fix everything or make it better. Or we think that simply scapegoating one part of the world, China, or one part of society, corporations, that somehow that's going to, you know, let us go into an us versus them thing that's going to work. But it's not like that. It's that humanity as a collective is going to have to get off of fossil fuels and find another way of organizing the global economy.
And it's clear from what you're saying, although you write that our effort to prevent climate change has failed, that's not an excuse to give up now.
That's right. There's at least three reasons for that. The first is the degree of the warming matters. If we have a 2-degree warming, 3-degree warming, 4-degree warming, all of those little numbers represent vastly greater levels of destruction and much greater risks in terms of catastrophic climate change. Secondly, the rate of the warming matters. We're much better at adjusting to a relatively slow warming than a very rapid warming, although the warming we're experiencing is going to be rapid by any standards. But thirdly, climate change is also going to reshape the way that we live, the kinds of things we do in terms of outdoor activities, where we take our children, the kinds of stories that we tell. And we're going to have to find new ways of meaning and new ways of telling those stories. And so there's a lot for us to do to slow down the warming, to limit its extent, and to figure out how to live in this new world we're creating.
Are we starting to turn from prevention to adaptation to, as you say, figure out how we're going to live in this changed world?
We're starting that turn. We're turning more slowly than I wish we would. And the other concern that I have is that a turn towards adaptation can actually make us too focused on ourselves. I mean, I live in New York. I lived through Hurricane Sandy. There's a high level of consciousness here now about storm surges and about the new normal and the superstorms and so on. But what there isn't a lot of consciousness of is it's not just New Yorkers that are going to be experiencing these things, not just Americans, but people in Mumbai, people in Karachi, people in Alexandria, people all over the world, including people who have emitted much less carbon than Americans have.
And that's part of the problem. You say sometimes the biggest harm will be in the places where the biggest responsibility isn't. The people emitting aren't the ones who will suffer the most.
That's right. So we need not only to adapt, but we also need to adapt our sense of empathy. And when we experience these impacts of climate change, we also have to understand that others are experiencing them, who have less resources in many cases than we do and have done less to cause it. So, there's no way of getting around the fact that we need a kind of globalization of consciousness that begins to match the kind of globalization of capital and of our economic system that we've seen develop over the last half century.
Where does that start? Where does that come from?
Well, it starts probably with taking responsibility for our own actions as individuals and recognizing that when we consume something, when we choose to drive instead of bike, for example, or walk, that we're really taking on this responsibility for where these fossil fuels come from, where they go, and so on. But it also, I think, involves changing the way that we think about our political choices and our choices as citizens as well.
You've also mentioned the role of the media in covering or maybe miscovering climate change. What do you think the media has done wrong? What would you like to see them, or I guess us, I'm part of it, do better?
Well, Rob, I'm holding you personally responsible for this, of course. No, I think there's two areas where the media have been quite unhelpful. One is in treating this as a kind of political story where it's one side against the other and one team has their facts and the other team has their facts. You know, the atmosphere is not a member of any political party. And no matter how much we talk about this, that, and the other thing, the greenhouse gases continue to reach the atmosphere and to change the climate. There's plenty of room to argue about what policy choices we should take in response to this problem. But there's really no reason to be arguing with the basic facts of the science. And the media too often has sort of treated this like a team sport. Here's the climate people who believe in climate change, the people who don't believe in climate change. That's really not the way to talk about science. The second problem, I think, is that it's a very difficult issue. It's a very confusing issue. And climate is actually an aspect of every other issue. So my favorite example of misservice that the media often performs is from my local hometown newspaper, the New York Times, where you can read, on the front page of the newspaper, that climate change is a terrible problem, no one's doing anything about it, and then you can read in the business section about how the price of oil is skyrocketing and what a terrible thing this is. You've got to put those two things together. Climate change is related to our meat consumption, to our energy consumption, to all of these things, and we really can't just say, oh, it's great when fossil fuels prices are cheap, but climate change is terrible. You've got to put those two thoughts together if you really want to educate your readers.
Do you see positive signs of change, whether at the policy level or at the people level?
Well, the biggest change is that from 1992 to 2009, all eyes of the world were on the global negotiations to try to bring climate change under control. Those negotiations essentially collapsed in 2009, though diplomats continued to fly around the world doing what diplomats do. And the action has really turned to towns, cities, regions, countries, and the national politics or the local politics in those places. And we're seeing a lot of action in the United States, in states and localities, but we're also seeing lots of action in other countries around the world as well. None of this action is enough. We're going to suffer. It's going to be a wild ride. But nevertheless, things are happening and things are beginning to move. We still need national action. The Obama administration has done pretty much what it can in terms of executive orders. But we need national legislation. We need to put a price on carbon. There won't really be any substitute for that.
Are you optimistic that something like that could happen? I know you've been working on this book for about 25 years. Is that going to happen in the next 25 years?
Well, you know, think like an optimist, live like a pessimist. It can happen. Will it happen? I don't know. But I know that every day when I get up in the morning, something good can happen. Some of it is just simply reducing meat consumption. Some of it is knowing that decisions are being made to regulate coal-fired power plants, for example, that hadn't been done in the past. So there's plenty of good things that can be done and will be done every day. There's plenty of good projects for us all to work on as individuals and in communities. So that gives me optimism. And humanity, at the end of the day, what makes us special, if anything, is that we're an extremely adaptable species, and we will adapt. Life will go on. Much will be lost. People will suffer. But there are things we can do to make it better.
Dale, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That was Dale Jamieson. He's professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University. His new book is Reason in a Dark Time: Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. It's been 3.5 years since crowds in Tahrir Square brought an end to Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak's rule. Since then, discussions of an Arab Spring have faded from the headlines, and the future of representative government throughout the Middle East is in doubt. Our next guest says, though, the 20-somethings who filled the streets and squares around the Middle East haven't gone anywhere, and he says that generation still wants the same things it demanded back in 2011. Juan Cole shares a more or less optimistic take on the aftermath of the Arab Spring in his new book, The New Arabs: How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Juan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, with what's happened in a place like Egypt since January of 2011, the Muslim Brotherhood winning an election, then widespread violence, what many call a military coup, restoring the army to power, does this story still apply, the story of young Arabs demanding and maybe achieving democracy?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. The young Arabs wanted more than just democracy. They wanted social justice, and they, above all, wanted an end to presidents for life and the prospect that the presidents for life were going to be succeeded by their sons, a kind of return to a dynastic principle within the Arab republics. And that was happening in Egypt, in Libya, in Yemen, in Tunisia and so forth, and they stopped it. I mean, that's one of the big things that that happened in 2011 was that the whole idea of the president for life and the succession within that family of presidents for life, that's on the trash heap of history.
And you say the responsibility for that win, that change, lies with these millennial generation Arabs. Why did they play such a central role?
Well, they just weren't going to take it anymore. The elders have told me that they were afraid. They were divided. They had gotten used to the situation. They had been convinced that nothing could be done. Many of them emigrated to the West out of despair. But these young 20-somethings believed that things could change and that they could make them change. And they were willing to make pragmatic, broad-based alliances to accomplish it. So the elders view them as generationally quite distinct in their attitudes and in their organizational prowess.
So what is it about this millennial generation in the Arab world that is so distinct from previous generations? What set them apart before we got to the Arab Spring?
They're much more urban than their parents or grandparents. You go back to the late 60s in Libya, and 80% of people were farmers, and they were out in the rural areas. It's now the reverse. Most people in Libya are living in cities. But, of course, the older of them weren't brought up in cities. These young people have been. So they're very urban. The post-colonial states that came into being with the end of colonialism after World War II were very big on universal education, and they set up vast school systems and hired teachers and went out into villages. So this young generation is nearly universally literate. They can read and write. They read newspapers, and then they're wired. They're on the internet. They watch satellite TV. Many of them have worked abroad. They're cosmopolitan. So they just have much wider horizons than their parents or grandparents who grew up in small villages.
And it seems important to note there are a lot of them. These are very young countries in terms of average age. The millennials are a baby boom in a way.
Absolutely. The population of Egypt has doubled since 1980, and it's the mean population of the Arab world, half of people under it, half of people over it, is 24. So the millennials, the people born between the late 1970s and the year 2000 or so, are over a third of the whole population.
And you focus on Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia for the most part in your book. What was the economic life like for millennials in those countries?
Well, you had very large numbers of people turning 18 or 22 every year who wanted a job. And these economies were not very good at providing the jobs. Ironically, they were even less good at providing jobs to educated youth than they were to people willing to do menial labor. And so if you had a BA, 30% of people highly educated were unemployed. The economies were sclerotic. They did have some growth spurts here and there, but they simply weren't attracting foreign investment at a very high level. In fact, the Arab world is among the worst in the world on the statistics for direct foreign investment. That's held them back. Then I think they lied. That is to say, you know, Tunisia reported 5% a year growth from the 1990s forward. I've been to Tunisia. I've been to other countries that had that kind of growth, and it doesn't look to me as though that could possibly be true. And it's also very suspicious. It's kind of a Madoff curve, 5% a year over a decade. So I think they weren't actually growing, and many Tunisian youth were forced to go to Europe for work. So their economic situation was very bad, and that was one of the reasons they were so dissatisfied.
So you have this large cohort, not a lot of jobs, a bad economy. They're urban, literate, wired. They're facing a corrupt government that looks like it's going to become, in effect, a presidential monarchy. Was something like this going to happen, whether it was a Tunisian street vendor setting himself on fire or something else? Do you think it was inevitable that something was going to trigger this kind of widespread revolt?
Yes, I think, given the situation that this was a tinderbox and anything could have set it off, these regimes were cartel regimes. They were being ruled by a kind of cronyism. So, you know, a lot of them had socialist tendencies back in the Cold War in the 60s and 70s. They modeled themselves to some extent on the East Bloc. But then from the 90s forward, after the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the East Bloc, there was pressure from the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, from Washington, Paris, and London, to privatize. But the problem is that if you have a president for life and he's presiding over an economy, half of which is in government hands, when it starts to privatize, there's an opportunity there for insider trading of a vast sort, because the ruling family knows what's going to be put on the block and where the good buying opportunities are, and they can call up their relatives or their close friends and make billionaires of them. And so that was what was being done. It was very corrupt, and that kind of corruption, you know, discourages foreign corporations from investing. Probably cut a point to 3 points a year off of growth. And so these youth saw these regimes as a huge old dam in the way of the progress of their generation, and they were determined to blow it up.
Well, fast forward a few years, they did, in fact, blow it up. Those particular regimes are gone now. When these millennials, and I'm sure there's a lot of diversity here, but in general, when they're talking about politics, are they looking back and saying mission accomplished, or are they looking ahead saying, here's what we haven't achieved yet?
Oh, the youth are very dissatisfied. I mean, nothing pleases them. They don't feel like they've accomplished what they set out to do at all, but they haven't given up. Probably the best transition we've seen is in Tunisia, where you had elections, you crafted a new constitution, there was a lot of compromise between the Muslim and the secular forces, and you've had a transition now to a technocratic caretaker government, which will oversee new elections. So, you know, from the political science literature and the experience of various countries with these kinds of transitions from a dictatorship to a democracy, you really couldn't ask for much better performance than Tunisia. But the Tunisians are all convinced that it's been a horror show and a complete catastrophe, and they're very upset with how things are going. So no, they're not resting on their laurels.
We're talking to Juan Cole. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan. His newest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're back with Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. You can join the conversation with your questions, your thoughts on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Juan, you make an analogy at one point to the Prague Spring, this uprising in Czechoslovakia in 1968. Looks like ultimately a failure, but then look forward a couple decades and the people leading that are running the place. Do you expect similar things from this generation in the Arab world, that governments will look very different when they take their experiences from the last few years and are in charge?
Yes. Well, one of the things we can confidently predict is that the current 60-somethings, who many of whom are uncomfortable with these youth revolutions and who have pushed back, they're not going to be in power in 20 or 30 years. They're not even going to be among us, whereas the 20-somethings in 20 or 30 years are going to be taking over. And while it is true that we can't be sure what their values will be at that point, the likelihood is that many of them will remain committed to the ideals for which they have fought, and those ideals are likely to be powerful and to have a shaping effect down the road.
One thing you point to in all three countries you write about is the egalitarian or sort of horizontal organization of protest movements among the youth. There was you referenced one of your colleagues saying something like, take me to your leader, and getting funny looks from protesters. Is that, do you think, going to shape the way they protest in years to come and maybe the way they exercise political power?
Yes, they haven't, it's not that they don't have leaders or that they don't have respect for leaders, but they, for the most part, they really prefer to organize themselves in networks. For that reason, one of the little noticed outcomes of these 2011 and after events has been an explosion of NGOs, of non-governmental organizations, many of them almost exclusively staffed by 20-somethings and 30-somethings, they simply didn't exist, in the zeros in the last decade. In a place like Libya, there were no NGOs, and now there are literally thousands of them, and they do all kinds of things from charity to culture kinds of work. And so a lot of the energies of this generation seem to be put into that kind of more egalitarian organization. They're so far not very into political parties, and this is maybe a fault in them, but that's where we are.
Now, you looked focused on the best case outcomes for these millennial youth protesters. There are other countries where things didn't come out that way, places like Qatar, where they were quelled by authoritarian governments, places like Yemen, where there was kind of a negotiated change of power, but not really meeting as many of their demands as elsewhere. But are there lessons that might apply to those places in the future that might have a different outcome?
Well, I should just underline that what I was studying was the youth movements, was movements of these young people that conceived themselves as being for the youth and trying to achieve their aspirations, express their grievances. So I didn't really make my choice of which countries to look at by outcomes, but by whether they had these big youth movements. And it just so happens that a place like Yemen is very rural. And while it did have a youth movement, it's maybe not the most important thing going on in that country. But certainly these movements were networked throughout the Arab world, to some extent internationally as well, but very tightly within among the Arab world. They gave each other advice. They debated tactics, ideals. And I think they had a broad influence, and I think one of the big takeaways is where regimes have been flexible enough to accommodate the basic demands of these youth movements, then things have gone all right. They haven't been paradise, but there's been a relatively soft landing. Where the regimes dug in and just refused to give an inch and were willing to deploy their military to resist the demands of the networked youth, it often has turned to civil war, or there's been a kind of repression that can't possibly be good for the economy or the society in the long run. And here one thinks of Syria. Even in Iraq, there was a kind of Sunni Arab Spring among young people in Fallujah and Mosul, which the government just crushed. And after they did that, people lost hope, and now terrorists have taken over. So, the next time there's a set of big demonstrations by young people in these countries, I'd advise the rulers to find a way to compromise rather than rolling tanks and trying to put them down, because militarizing this kind of social conflict rips the society apart.
You mentioned terrorism. A lot of the worry in the Western world is that disaffected young people, maybe millennials in particular, will want to turn toward religious parties or religious-affiliated parties like the Muslim Brotherhood-supported political parties in Egypt, or to terrorist groups maybe as extreme as ISIS. Is there a competition almost between the sort of, I think we call it a leftist protesting we've been talking about, and drawing people into terrorist organizations?
Well, there is a big divide among the youth of the Arab world between what I call the new left and those who favor the religious right. And there's a further divide within the religious right between people who favor peaceful and parliamentary procedures and those who are willing to pick up a gun. So the new left is too often, in my view, discounted or unknown in Western analysis, whereas in a place like urban Egypt, I think it's predominant. And it certainly was the leading edge of the 2011 revolutions. This is true in Tunisia as well. It's true in Yemen. One forgets now that Marxism and other forms of leftist thought had powerful purchase in much of the Arab world. In fact, you had South Yemen was communist for years and for decades. And the Communist Party in Iraq at one point really amounted to something. And these leftist movements, leftist parties are gone or very weak. But I argue this kind of millions and millions of red diaper babies in the Arab world who have leftist tendencies, who sympathize with workers and worker rights, and sympathize with farmers and the difficulties they face now with global warming and water shortages. And despite being urban, there's a kind of middle class youth link to factory workers and farmers, that this is a big important political complex in many of these countries, which we just don't hear so much about. And in a place like Tunisia, you know, the people who support a terrorist organization like Ansar al-Sharia are just a very tiny group. Now, they can make a lot of trouble because they have guns and so forth, but they're just not demographically important. And none of those kinds of people, you know, did well in the elections that were held. In Egypt now, not only have those kinds of radicals been crushed, but even the mainstream Muslim Brotherhood certainly is not a terrorist organization, even though the generals consider it one. There's an attempt to crush it as well, but I don't imagine that the core, you know, constituency for the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is more than 10 or 20%. So I think we have, you know, a little bit of a distorted view of the region in the sense that the people with the guns make a big splash, and one hears a lot about them. But the young kind of democratic socialists of the region, it seems to me, are really much more mainstream.
In past flare-ups between Israelis and Palestinians, that has definitely influenced politics elsewhere in the Arab world. How do you see that affecting millennial politics, the youth movements that you're talking about this time around?
Well, the Arab millennials, you know, like Arabs in general, have a great deal of sympathy with the Palestinians in general, object to how they perceive them to be being treated by the Israelis. But in these revolutions, for the most part, they declined to make those foreign policy issues central to their protests. I've been in Egypt on a number of occasions since 2011, and in 2011, and in the summer of 2011, there was a month-long kind of Tahrir Square, downtown Cairo, set of enormous protests in July of that year. And I went down there every day and took pictures of placards and talked to people. And I didn't see a single poster or piece of graffiti that referred to the United States or Israel.
Juan, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. His new book is The New Arabs: How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East.